We have to shake this country up. This country has to come back, and it's never going to come back unless we have people like Marjorie Taylor Greene. Please come up. Come. Come on up, Marjorie.
Thank you, Mr. President. All right.
Ever since her election to Congress in 2020, Marjorie Taylor Greene has been one of the more extreme members of the Republican Party.
Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene is under fire for her social media activity. Now, she's already known for supporting extremist conspiracy theories, and CNN is now reporting on her posts and others she's liked that seem to call for violence against Democrats.
Even Greene's fellow Republicans have had a hard time working with her. The House Freedom Caucus abandoned her last summer. And now she's trying to oust House Speaker Mike Johnson.
Mike Johnson is not capable of that job. He has proven it over and over again.
Despite all of this, Marjorie Taylor Greene still wields a lot of power within the party.
Experience has shown that creating this kind of controversy can be extremely lucrative in terms of campaign contributions.
David Kirkpatrick is a staff writer at The New Yorker. As he explains in his latest piece, Marjorie Taylor Greene's appetite for controversy is a huge part of what makes her such a successful fundraiser. I asked David to come on the show to discuss what motivates Greene and what her recent efforts mean for the Republican Party. You're listening to The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett, and I'm a senior editor at The New Yorker. Hey, David. Thanks so much for being here.
It's my pleasure.
So I want to start by asking you about this attempt by Congresswoman Greene to oust House Speaker Mike Johnson. They're both super conservative Republicans and Trump supporters. So why does Greene want Johnson out? Like, what is the backstory here?
So what Greene has said is that Johnson is selling out, that he's working too much with the Democrats, or as she says it, turning over the speakership to Senator Chuck Schumer, Democratic Senate leader.
This is the third betrayal by Mike Johnson.
She's most incensed by the deals that he reached with Democrats in the White House and the Senate over spending, and even more than that, the deal to fund aid to Ukraine.
And then he did this bullshit in here on the House floor, foreign war package that does nothing for America. It's unbelievable.
Very strongly opposes additional aid to help Ukraine fend off Russia's invasion. And when Mike Johnson went ahead and allowed a House vote on a $61 billion aid bill, she began stepping up her threats to try to vacate the chair, as they call it, to make a motion that would require a vote of the House to remove him. But that may not be the full story. You know, we should be cynical about the motives of all politicians. And it's worth noting that Marjorie Taylor Greene is actually one of the most successful fundraisers in the House of Representatives. In fact, of all the lawmakers in the House of Representatives, she is the one who receives the most of their campaign donations in the form of small donations. And experience has shown, especially the experience of Marjorie Taylor Greene's career, that this kind of thing, opposing your own party from the right, creating this kind of controversy, can be extremely lucrative in terms of those campaign contributions.
Has that always been the case? Going after people from your own party is a great way to fundraise? Seems kind of counterintuitive.
Well, if you talk to outside groups on the left or the right that did direct mail fundraising back in the days before email, they'll tell you, of course. You know, if you're a conservative group and the Republicans are in power, then why are people going to give you money unless you are saying, gosh, these Republicans are selling you out and we've got to hold their feet to the fire? Ditto on the left, if you're, you know, some environmental or feminist group, you've got to hold the Democrats' feet to the fire. But two things have happened. The main thing is the internet. You know, the internet has supercharged that kind of small dollar fundraising. And the second thing is that members of Congress in the chamber have realized that the same logic applies to them, that if you are going to be to the right of your party leaders and say to the base, hey, I'm the only one here holding their feet to the fire and standing up for your principles, that's a great way to raise those small dollar donations. Marjorie Taylor Greene is really the prime example.
So, I mean, you mentioned earlier that, you know, we should probably be cynical. I mean, do you land in a certain way when it comes to the question of whether Greene actually has an issue with Mike Johnson versus, you know, trying to take advantage of a fundraising opportunity?
I have no reason to believe that she's not sincere. I don't think she secretly thinks that funding Ukraine is a great idea.
Yeah.
I think she probably is quite opposed to it on America First grounds. She would rather see that money stay home, as would a lot of her supporters. Now, at the same time, she's operating in a world where threatening to oust the speaker in an election year is very bad for her party. Actually, ousting the speaker in an election year is even worse. And so when she's taking into account all of those practicalities, does she also take into the practicality that this is an opportunity for her to raise a ton of money? Yes, I assume she does.
I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit more about what makes her such a good fundraiser. I mean, you mentioned the online tactics and whatnot, but what is it about her that helps her raise so much money?
Well, she is speaking to the base. She's saying to the most partisan and ideological voters out there, or supporters, I'm here for you. You know, I'm not about the party. I'm here for you. Her counterpart on the left would be Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, AOC, who's also the biggest small-dollar fundraiser for the Democrats and a huge source of fundraising, in part because she says to the base on the left, look, I'm here for you, and I'm holding the Main Street Democrats' feet to the fire. I'm making them stick to their promises to you, the real hardcore ideological left, the base.
So tell me how Marjorie Taylor Greene's political career began. Like, how did we get here?
You know, when Marjorie Taylor Greene first entered politics 4 years ago, she was not a natural fundraiser by any stretch. She had her own money. She co-owns a construction company that her father founded, and she owns a CrossFit gym. And she actually loaned or gave her own campaign something like $1.4 million. But between when she was elected in November 2020 and when she was sworn in January 2021, a lot of stuff came to light, a long series of quite incendiary statements that she had made in one format or another. She talked about hanging Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. She most famously talked about wildfires in California that might have been started by space lasers funded by the Rothschilds. She suggested that George Soros, the Jewish financier, was in fact a Nazi. And when all of this came to light, she became a real figure of national attention, almost all of it negative if you were reading the national media. She also discovered that that made her a real fundraising star. The money started to pour in. She raised a huge amount of money that first year, and really that set the template. It became clear in her own career that controversy was very, very lucrative in terms of campaign contributions.
My family, they're from Arizona, and they're pretty conservative. And I feel like they have sometimes kind of cringed at the stuff that Marjorie Taylor Greene has done. Like, I'm thinking about the State of the Union, just like the way that she was dressed and kind of making a scene.
Not really.
I guess it's surprising to me that there wouldn't be more mainstream Republicans who are just alienated by the kinds of things that she's doing.
Well, if your family sits on their hands and does not write her a check, that doesn't hurt her at all, as long as there's some other people out there who do. You know, you bring up her interruptions during the recent State of the Union address. I remember a few years ago, Representative Joe Wilson, a Republican, got a lot of negative attention in the media for interrupting an address by Barack Obama and shouting out, "You lie." In fact, the next day, his campaign said he brought in $1 million in small donations.
Wow.
And in many ways, that set the template. It was quite extraordinary when he did it. And now Marjorie Taylor Greene has really made a habit of interrupting each one of President Biden's State of the Union addresses in one way or another.
You know, you mentioned that she's taking a page from former Republicans, but like, who are her allies?
You know, she's been really interesting to watch and in some ways astute. You know, as you mentioned, the Freedom Caucus, the far right group within the House, expelled her because she was criticizing her fellow ultra-conservatives. She then kind of cut to the middle and became an ally of former Speaker McCarthy. In fact, he adopted her as a kind of informal advisor, a sort of policy advisor, and she stopped criticizing him. In fact, when another group of conservatives successfully moved to remove him last fall, she was supportive. And so now it's a little bit of a surprise that after having supported Speaker McCarthy, who was really more of an establishment type, she's turning against Speaker Johnson, who's certainly more conservative than Speaker McCarthy, and really probably, if you look at his record, more conservative than almost anyone else in the House.
David, I'd like to ask you more about the donations that Greene is raking in and what she's doing with them, but first we're going to take a quick break. You'll hear more of the political scene from The New Yorker in just a moment.
You come to The New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.
You mentioned that Green is especially good at bringing in individual small donors, which is interesting because I feel like a lot of the discourse around campaign finance law up until pretty recently was about the power of corporations spending, you know, huge amounts of money on campaigns. And so I guess I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit more about the way in which small donors have become powerful.
Yeah, you know, really since forever, since at least the 1970s, campaign finance reform types have always hoped that we could get politicians to rely more on small donors. You know, the fear was always that these big institutional moneyed interests, labor unions on the left and corporations on the right, were going to distort politics and twist our government in their interests. And if only we could get the politicians to rely on regular old mom and pop folks, small folks making small donations, that would make them so much more responsive, or so we all imagine.
Yeah.
But various campaign finance rules failed to accomplish that, and the internet succeeded, really. The way that the internet democratized fundraising, as we saw in the presidential campaigns of Howard Dean and then Barack Obama and then Donald Trump, really changed everything. It made it a lot easier for politicians to get their messages targeted to individual voters and much, much easier for those voters at very little effort or cost to contribute, you know, 5, 10, 20, 30 bucks to these politicians. And soon you had huge amounts of money. And that had a couple of consequences. First of all, for the individual politician, it incentivizes controversy, right? Because it quickly becomes clear, just as we've learned in so many ways about the internet, that it's very, very polarizing, and being shocking and getting attention and being viral is the way to really make that engine run. So there's a reward for controversy. At the same time, the institutions that used to discipline those politicians, the political parties, became weaker and weaker. Various different campaign finance reforms or judicial rulings had the effect, on the one hand, of limiting contributions to those political parties, and then, on the other hand, of allowing outside groups, you know, so-called super PACs or nonprofit advocacy groups, to raise and spend unlimited amounts of money, often from anonymous donors, in order to influence political campaigns. And so those two things, limiting donations to the parties and enabling donations to other non-party groups, weakened the parties. So the parties used to have a kind of disciplining effect. They would say, in effect, look, if you're going to sabotage our speaker, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican, we're not going to like it. We're not going to help you out when you need our support in the election. We're not going to help your friends out. It's really going to be bad for you. And that had a kind of restraining impact. And so we've got this 1-2 punch. On the one hand, let's take Marjorie Taylor Greene. You see that controversy is very lucrative in terms of your own campaign coffers, and you don't care as much as you used to about what the Republican Party thinks of you.
You mentioned Trump earlier and how he was propped up by small donors. I guess I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about what his situation is now, because my understanding is that he is struggling, at least struggling more now than he used to with getting small donors. And so that's why he's been at Mar-a-Lago kind of courting billionaires for the past few months. And maybe that's because he's also trying to raise money for his legal fees as well. And I guess it's interesting to me, if assuming that the thing that I read is still accurate, that Green is doing so well with small donors, and yet Trump, who also seems to be employing a pretty similar strategy, is not doing as well.
I'm not sure we're ready to say that Trump is not doing as well. I think he still has quite a hold on the base and is able to raise those small dollar donations. On the other hand, he's been squeezing that constituency pretty hard for a lot of years now. You know, there's only so much you can get out of people. And we'll see how that goes as the campaign goes on. But as you yourself suggested, it may also be that those mom-and-pop donors who used to send him 10 or 15 or 20 or 100 bucks are noticing that some of that money is going to his own legal defenses, which may not be where they would most likely to spend their money. So I think it's too soon to tell how that's going to shake out as the campaign accelerates.
You know, you mentioned in your piece that Green actually represents a pretty safe Republican district. And so I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about, you know, whether she actually needs all the money that her campaign is bringing in, and if not, where is she sending it?
Well, in Congress, campaign money is political power.
Yeah.
That's the way to rise up in the leadership within the party. That's the way to cultivate loyalty of your fellow members. One reason I think that the other Republicans tolerate Green is that she actually pays a significant amount of money to their campaign committee to help elect other Republicans. Over the last two election cycles, she's contributed more than $700,000 so far. So she's doing her part. It's a little bit odd. You know, on the one hand, she's saying, oh, these Republicans are all sellouts. You can't trust them. On the other hand, she's helping to bankroll
them.
Yeah,
it sounds like she's kind of a team player when you put it that way.
In some ways, she is a team player. And they're directing that money, of course, to the contested races where it matters, which means electing moderate Republicans. But so it goes. She continues to raise money at the expense of her fellow Republicans and then to pay that money back into combined Republican coffers.
How did Green's break with the Freedom Caucus affect her, you know, fundraising abilities and her general reputation?
I don't think it really penetrated the conscience of your average voter. Only people like you and me who are really paying close attention notice the Freedom Caucus as such, I think. Those controversial remarks of hers, the space lasers funded by the Rothschilds, that stuff, that cost her committee assignments during her first term. She was stripped of any committee assignments, which you would think would be crippling. You know, that's committee assignments are political power, and that's what most lawmakers use to raise money from lobbyists and others. And she had none of them. But it turned out in her case that didn't slow her down at all because she was making money off of the controversy.
I'm wondering if we can go back to something that you mentioned earlier, which is Green's relationship with the previous House Speaker, Kevin McCarthy. It seems interesting that she would have cozied up to him, but then is going so hard against Johnson. And I'm wondering if you could talk about why she found that relationship with McCarthy helpful.
You know, I don't really know what's going on in her relationship with Speaker Johnson. A lot was written about her relationship with Speaker McCarthy in the New York Times, in the Washington Post, and elsewhere. And it was clear that it was mutually beneficial. On the one hand, for Speaker McCarthy, you know, he was an establishment guy. He was a kind of a Chamber of Commerce Republican all along. And he struggled a little bit to reach the most conservative members of his own conference and also the base that they represented. So she could be a kind of a surrogate there. She could validate him and help him with that constituency because she had become a kind of icon to those voters. And he could help her. Right. Each one of those articles about how close they were made her look more powerful and more influential. So they were both winning in that sense. Clearly, that relationship has not existed with Speaker Johnson. Speaker Johnson, as is his general, you know, operating procedure, always describes her as a close friend and someone with whom he agrees with substantially. But clearly, they don't have the same kind of symbiotic partnership that she had with McCarthy. And I can only guess that that's partly because Speaker Johnson doesn't need her. He doesn't really need someone to be his intermediary reaching out to the most conservative voters.
I'm wondering if you can talk about the people who are advising Green, like if she's taking advice from anyone or if she's really just going rogue.
Well, most notably, soon after she arrived and struck gold in small-dollar fundraising, she brought on board a chief of staff named Ed Buckham. Ed Buckham, years ago, more than 20 years ago, became well-known as the right hand, if you will, of former Republican Majority Leader Tom DeLay. Tom DeLay, with Buckham's help and advice, built the preeminent conservative fundraising machine of his day and used it to rise to the position of Republican leader. And along the way, cultivated the nickname The Hammer for his ability to use that money to discipline other members and keep them in line. It got both of them into trouble. Your listeners may not even remember this, but the influence peddling scandal around Jack Abramoff brought down both of them. One of DeLay's aides was linked to Abramoff and pled guilty to some criminal charges. DeLay resigned as leader and didn't run again. And Buckham, who by that time had left and set up his own lobbying shop, was also sort of tarnished by it, although neither one of them was ever charged with any crime. And so Marjorie Taylor Greene has kind of thrown him a lifeline. You know, after two decades in the wilderness, she's brought Buckham back. And he appears to be trying to help her climb the ladder, just as he did Tom DeLay years ago. Certainly, he's someone who understands the conservative mindset and very much understands how to use political money to build political power.
So I want to ask you more about Green's future in the party, but first we're going to take another break. The Political Scene from The New Yorker will be right back.
I'm Alex Schwartz.
I'm Nomi Fry.
I'm Vincent Cunningham, and this is Critics at Large, a New Yorker podcast for the culturally curious.
Each week, we're going to talk about a big idea that's showing up across the cultural landscape, and we'll trace it through all the mediums we love: books, movies, television, music, art.
And I always want to talk about celebrity gossip, too.
Of course.
What are you guys excited to cover in the next few months?
There's a new translation of the Iliad that's coming out, Emily Wilson.
Oh.
Really excited to see whether I can read the Iliad again, whether I'm that literate. The jury is out.
I can't wait to hear Adam Driver go again in an Italian accent in Michael Mann's Ferrari.
He can't stop.
I mean, and bless him. I can't wait.
Molto bene.
Molto bene.
We hope you'll join us for new episodes each Thursday. Follow Critics at Large today, wherever you get podcasts.
You really don't want to miss this.
Don't.
Don't miss this.
Don't miss it.
See you soon.
So it's been a few weeks since Green said that she wants to oust Johnson from the speakership, and it now sounds like she's trying to pull the trigger next week. She said that she's been trying to be responsible by not rushing it, but what do you think took her so long, and what are the odds that she could actually pull this off?
You know, that's a very good question. At this point, we can be pretty confident she's not going to succeed. For one thing, President Trump has come out to support Mike Johnson. It would be a truly extraordinary thing for the Republicans to publicly challenge their own speaker months before an election. It would be an even more extraordinary thing to actually remove that speaker. It would be a disaster for the Republicans in the fall. So there are a lot of reasons why her conference is not going to want her to move ahead with this. And then on top of that, the Democrats have come out and said that they would vote to block her motion, that is, to save Speaker Johnson, which means that she has virtually no chance of succeeding with her motion. And yet, she said she plans to go ahead anyway, to call for the vote, just to make everybody go on the record with where they would stand.
Why do you think that the Democrats would block the motion? I mean, do they suddenly really like Mike Johnson and think that he's a great speaker?
Oh, by no means. By no means. The Democrats have no love for Mike Johnson at all and would certainly like, as soon as possible, to remove him as speaker, ideally to replace him with one of their own. But at the moment, I think they've concluded that Marjorie Taylor Greene's motion to remove him is not going to succeed. And so they actually may see some advantage in publicly volunteering to save him. That is, he doesn't need their help, and by volunteering it, they make him look bad. They're actually kind of causing more trouble for him than they are for her in some ways, because among his members, being saved by the Democrats is really the kiss of death.
It's interesting because even Trump himself has come out in support of Johnson. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on the balance that someone like Green has to strike. How many times can you really come out in support of something that the big guy doesn't support? And like, at what point do you then risk alienating his supporters?
I don't think that many politicians on either side of the aisle are too troubled by consistency and the need for it. I think she's doing just fine. You know, Trump, it's true, has twice now come out and expressed support for Johnson or even rebuffed Marjorie, calling her by her first name. You know, it's clear that he still feels warmly towards her and she's kind of a super fan of his. I think what you're getting at here is the balancing act that Speaker Johnson has embraced. You know, when he raised his hand for this job, I think it's clear that what he thought he could do that other people might not be able to is to keep all these plates spinning at once. And that means keeping the conservative members of the House on side, keeping the more moderate members of the House on side, and keeping Donald Trump on side. So, you know, I recently wrote a profile of Speaker Johnson, and one of the things that emerges is that he and his staff definitely see that as the challenge that he faces, that he's got all of those conflicting constituencies, including President Trump right now, the most important figure in the Republican Party, and he's got to keep them all happy. That's what he's trying to do. And when you see this challenge from Marjorie Taylor Greene, then it begins to make more sense why Speaker Johnson was operating the way he was in terms of cultivating President Trump and keeping him happy even as he moved forward to fund the money for Ukraine.
I feel like you occasionally see Green floated around as a possible VP pick for Trump. I'm wondering if you take that idea seriously at all, and that might be part of what she's doing here.
I personally would be surprised. You know, I'm not in the room for former President Trump's speculations or considerations about who his VP pick might be. But from an outside perspective, I don't see that she brings that much to the table. You know, like President Trump, she's quite polarizing. The voters she brings are the ones that already adore him. And we're in an election now where the question of anti-Semitism is a weapon in the hands of the Republicans, and in particular President Trump, I think, as he squares off against the Democrats and tries to capitalize on these campus protests over the war in Gaza. And in that context, why would you bring on a vice presidential candidate who has even a whiff of anti-Semitism about them? You know,
yeah.
The Jewish space lasers, the George Soros, the Nazi, no need to get into that.
Thank you so much, David.
It's been a pleasure.
David Kirkpatrick is a staff writer at The New Yorker. You can read his work at newyorker.com. This has been The Political Scene. I'm Tyler Foggett. The show is produced by Julia Nutter and edited by Gianna Palmer, with production assistance from Jake Loomis and Mike Kutchman. Our executive producer is Stephen Valentino. Chris Bannon is Condé Nast's head of global audio. Our theme music is by Allison Leighton Brab. Enjoy your week, and we'll see you next Wednesday.
This week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, presidential candidate Robert F. Kennedy Jr. He's never held elected office, but he's still running for president.
There's nothing in the United States Constitution that says that you have to go to Congress first and then Senate second, or be a governor before you're elected to the presidency of the United States.
A conversation with RFK Jr. on the New Yorker Radio Hour from WNYC Studios. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.